Attention, attention. This is History Lost in Time.
And welcome to episode 61 of the History Lost in Time podcast. This podcast is available in German and English on YouTube, Spotify, and podcast.de with a social media presence on Blue Sky and Instagram. Note for Spotify users, you can find the latest episodes on Spotify. For all episodes since the beginning, please visit podcast.de and YouTube.
The topic of this episode.
The year is 1923. Germany is reeling between hyperinflation, attempted coups, and the long shadow of the Treaty of Versailles. Amidst this chaos, a man takes the reins who remains an enigma to many, Gustav Stresemann. A pragmatic Republican, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate in the Stresemann suit named after him, he attempted to reconcile the impossible, the pride of an old era with the reality of a new world. In this episode, we look behind the scenes of diplomacy, at the man who gave Germany and Europe a respite while battling against time and his own health.
Political agenda and background.
None.
The sources that were used.
Source 1. Martin Sabro, Violence Against Weimar, The Early Republic's Trials, 1918-23, Waldstein Verlag, Göttingen, 2023. Source 2. Nadine Rossol, Benjamin Ziemann, Upheaval and Abyss, The Handbook of the Weimar Republic, WBG, Darmstadt, 2021. Source 3. Hans Mommsen, The Rise and Fall of the Weimar Republic, 1918-33, Ullstein Propyläen, Berlin, 1998. Source 4. Bernd Braun, The Chancellors of the Weimar Republic, Kohlhammer Verlag, Stuttgart, 2013. Gustav Stresemann was born on May 10, 1878, in Berlin, the youngest of eight children. His parents were quite well off. They ran a bottled beer business with an attached tavern and also owned several apartment buildings. Gustav Stresemann was the only one of the children to attend a higher school, a fact due to the children's aptitude, not the cost. During his school years, Stresemann became an avid reader. His mother died in 1895, a loss that deeply affected the then 17-year-old. He originally wanted to become a journalist, but alongside journalism he also studied some economics. He began his studies in Berlin, but transferred to Leipzig, and then focused entirely on economics. In 1900 he wrote his doctoral dissertation on the development of the Berlin bottled beer trade, a topic that his opponents apparently didn't consider serious enough. Hard to believe in beer-loving Germany, which is why this dissertation later earned him much ridicule. From 1901 to 1919, he worked in industrial associations, including the Saxon League of Industrialists, where he served as vice president since 1911. He became politically active as early as 1896, when he joined the National Social Association. This was not a precursor organization to the National Socialists, even though the name was similar, but rather a party that sought to combine national and social values and was more of a liberal party. The crushing electoral defeat of 1903 more or less led to the party's collapse. Most members joined the left-liberal free-minded party. Stresemann, however, chose the right-liberal National Liberal Party, as this better suited his career as an industrial lobbyist. In 1906 he was elected to the Dresden City Council for the National Liberal Party. He was elected to the Reichstag in 1907. At 28 he was the youngest member of the Reichstag at the time. He quickly gained recognition for his rhetorical talent and journalistic work. Although he lost his direct mandate to the Social Democrats in 1912, he was able to return to the Reichstag in a by-election in 1914. In the period before the war, he supported the interests of business and white-collar workers in domestic policy, while in foreign policy he followed the line of Wilhelm II. He advocated for further naval expansion and was also a member of the German Colonial Society. During the First World War, Stresemann was a domestic supporter of the reformist wing of the Reich, which advocated for parliamentarization and solutions to the social question. In foreign policy, he was close to the right-wing forces of the Reich, who favored annexations in both the West and the East. Stresemann was particularly aggressive in his criticism of Great Britain, with which he desired no reconciliation even after the war. He was also an early supporter of unrestricted submarine warfare, an opponent of Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, and he opposed the Reichstag's peace resolutions. Due to his public persona, he was considered the parliamentary mouthpiece of the Supreme Army Command under Hindenburg-Ludendorff. At the end of 1917, he became chairman of the National Liberal Party's parliamentary group in the Reichstag and simultaneously deputy party chairman. In a speech before the Reichstag in June 1918, he appeared completely confident of victory. Source 4 contains the following excerpt on pages 67 and 68. "The German victories have opened the door to peace in the East and thus the possibility of new political options there. The outcome of the World War is now being decided on the battlefields of the West. It would be an offense, a crime, to allow doubts about victory to arise now that the collapse of hostile sentiment is becoming apparent. May what Hindenburg said back then, under much more difficult circumstances, just a year ago in June 1917, come to pass. The times are hard, but victory is certain." Stresemann, like many others, failed to recognize the signs of the times. He saw neither the internal collapse nor the collapse on the Western Front coming. When the Supreme Army Command urgently recommended to the Reich government in September 1918 to begin armistice negotiations, and when the Reich was parliamentarized in October 1918, Stresemann was more or less politically isolated due to his earlier positions. After the revolution, the formation of a unified liberal party failed because of him. While the pro-democratic forces gathered in the left-liberal German Democratic Party, DDP, Stresemann founded the German People's Party, DVP, an anti-democratic, pro-business party that rejected both the Weimar Constitution and the Treaty of Versailles. During the Kapp-Putsch of 1920, the DVP adopted a wait-and-see approach and did not openly support either Kapp or the government. Up to this point, Stresemann had been a fervent monarchist. Source 2 characterizes the DVP on page 177 as follows. "The DVP was a center-right party in the political spectrum of the Weimar Republic, which used German nationalism to alternately attack and support the Republic. Under its chairman Gustav Stresemann, the party reluctantly embarked on a path to stabilize the Republic. Sometime between 1920 and 22, Stresemann evolved into a pragmatic Republican. He realized that Germany had no chance with the methods of the political right. Total opposition, rejection of the Republic, sympathy for coup ideas, and foreign policy illusions based on secret rearmament and the violent reconquest of the 1871 borders. He now attempted to pursue realpolitik within the political framework of the Republic instead of remaining politically marginalized. This suited the Weimar parties, the SPD, DDP and Center Party, very well, as the DVP was needed for a stable majority. Two things thus coincided. Stresemann had moved closer to the Republic, and he was needed. When Chancellor Wilhelm Kuno resigned in the summer of 1923, he left behind seemingly insurmountable challenges. The mega-crisis gripping Germany consisted of the occupation of the Ruhr in the west, hyperinflation, and unrest and uprisings from both the left and right across the country. After numerous governments, Germany appeared almost like a failed state and ungovernable. Nevertheless, the 45-year-old Stresemann agreed to take on the hot seat of chancellorship. He led a grand coalition of the SPD, the Center Party, the DDP and the DVP. 70% of parliament supported the chancellor. However, the left wing of the SPD and the right wing of the DVP opposed this cooperation from the outset. Stresemann, however, forced his own party into this coalition. Source 3 states on page 180,
He was aware of the fact that due to the precarious foreign policy situation, the Reich could not afford the internal political trench warfare between the working class and the bourgeoisie without suffering serious damage.
Stresemann was his own foreign minister and remains the only liberal chancellor Germany has ever had. He ended the Ruhr conflict barely a month after taking office. On September 26, 1923, Reich President Friedrich Ebert, together with the Stresemann government, issued a joint appeal calling for an end to passive resistance in the Ruhr region. However, Stresemann made it clear that reparations payments would only be made once German sovereignty over the Ruhr had been restored. This put the ball in France's court. This gave Stresemann some leeway in foreign policy, as talks with France were now at least theoretically possible again, even though the Poincaré government initially refused all negotiations with the government in Berlin. At the end of October, however, France launched an initiative that culminated in the Dawes Plan, the first reparations plan for Germany, marking a shift in the French position. Domestically, however, there was a storm of outrage from the right wing. The DNVP and the radical right spoke of the capitulation of the Ruhr and demanded that Stresemann be brought before the state court for high treason. In early October 1923, Stresemann defended himself before the Reichstag with words printed in Source 4 on pages 93-94.
I would like to say to those who justify these attacks with their nationalistic sentiments, the courage to take on the task of passive resistance responsibly is perhaps more national than the phrases used to combat it. I was aware that the moment I did so as leader of my party, which was oriented in a completely different direction, I was not only jeopardizing my own political position within the party, but indeed my life. But what do we lack in the German people? We lack the courage to take responsibility.
The right wing of the German People's Party also rebelled against Stresemann, demanding measures for currency stabilization that the Social Democratic Party could not possibly accept for social policy reasons. Stresemann therefore resigned at the beginning of October 1923, but was immediately tasked by President Ebert with forming a new government. A compromise between the SPD and DVP was reached in mid-October, and the currency reform was passed in the Reichstag with 316 out of 348 votes. On October 15, 1923, the German Rentenbank was founded, the basis of the Rentenmark, essentially the new Reichsmark, which replaced the old worthless mark. Finance Minister Hans Luther had organized this currency reform, while Stresemann had pushed it through politically. In November 1923, the Rentenmark replaced the devalued mark, thus enabling Germany to make a fresh economic start. Source 3 states on page 187.
The stabilization of the German currency through the introduction of the Rentenmark represents an astonishing achievement of the Stresemann government. That it did not collapse under the barrage of interest groups was primarily due to the fact that the devaluation of the mark had progressed beyond all expectations.
It is important to know that some of these measures were only made possible by an enabling act. Enabling acts, which temporarily suspended or circumvented the Constitution, were therefore not an invention of Adolf Hitler in 1933, but rather had a certain tradition. However, the enabling acts before 1933 were more narrowly formulated, time-limited, and intended to provide for a return to constitutional order. Enabling acts were meant to alleviate emergencies, not to suspend the constitution, and in the autumn of 1923, Germany was in a state of absolute emergency. Within barely 2 months, Stresemann had achieved enormous things in foreign and economic policy, but these measures came at a price. In Küstrin, there was an uprising of the Black Reichswehr, which, however, collapsed. In Thuringia and Saxony, popular front governments were formed with the participation of the Communist Party of Germany, the KPD. In Hamburg, an uprising of left-wing extremist groups broke out at the end of October and had to be violently suppressed. And in Bavaria, a right-wing putsch took place. an event that is hardly remembered anymore due to Hitler's beer hall putsch that overshadows it. But let's take it one step at a time. The KPD's participation in the governments of Saxony and Thuringia led to the Reichswehr marching into both states at the end of October and beginning of November 1923, respectively, and ousting the Popular Front governments. This resulted in fighting and fatalities. In September 1923, the Bavarian state government, controlled by the Bavarian People's Party BVP, declared a state of emergency in response to the end of the Ruhr conflict and appointed Gustav Ritter von Kahr as General State Commissioner. He was thus in effect a kind of dictator in Bavaria. This had a certain backstory. During the Kapp Putsch of 1920, Kahr and the BVP had ousted the Social Democratic Party, which was then governing Bavaria, and after the putsch's failure, he established a safe haven for right-wing enemies of the Republic within Bavaria. Although Kahr had returned to his former post as president of the government of Upper Bavaria in 1921, he remained ready to take over again. The Kapp Putsch had failed due to amateurishness. A repeat of this was not to be allowed. In response to Kahr's declaration of state of emergency in Bavaria, the government in Berlin declared a nationwide state of emergency and transferred executive power to Reichswehr Minister Gessler. Theoretically, Gessler should now have commanded all army and paramilitary units in Germany. In Bavaria, however, Kahr placed these units under his own command. While the Reichswehr readily invaded Saxony and Thuringia to combat the communists, it refused to invade Bavaria. Chancellor Stresemann could initially only wait, as he lacked the power to act against Bavaria. Officially, Kahr intended to establish a border guard force with the paramilitary organizations in northern Bavaria, but it was an open secret that the plan was to create a force for a march on Berlin. The model was likely Mussolini's march on Rome in the autumn of 1922. Kahr had General Lossow, the head of the Reichswehr in Bavaria, and Colonel Seisser of the Bavarian State Police as allies. To increase their chances of success, they established connections with right-wing groups outside Bavaria, such as the Stahlhelm. They also held talks with Reichswehr Chief von Seeckt, who sympathized with Kahr's plan and would have preferred a right-wing coup government under Reich President Ebert. In mid-October 1923, the Nazi Party under Adolf Hitler also joined the Kahr-Lossow-Seisser Triumvirat. Technically, the government in Berlin had lost control of Bavaria. Although Lossow was officially dismissed, he immediately received a replacement position in the Bavarian government and thus remained in office, sort of. Bavaria, therefore, ignored the instructions from Berlin. How was the coup supposed to proceed? Source 1 describes the plan on page 212. Disguised as an autumn exercise in 1923 and under strict secrecy, the Munich Military District Command ordered the paramilitary units to be integrated into the 7th Reichswehr Division Bavaria. One division was to become three. Mobilization was to begin on November 15th and be completed 3 days later. By the end of October, all the essential preparations were complete. Names were mentioned with regard to the future dictatorial government. Kahr was intended for a prominent position. The days of German democracy seemed numbered. Final talks between von Seeckt and Seisser took place in early November. Von Seeckt recommended waiting a little longer. He didn't want the troops marching from Bavaria to Berlin to clash with Reichswehr units in Thuringia or Saxony, as this could have jeopardized the putsch. Kahr understood this, and therefore slowed down. However, Hitler and his NSDAP were not informed of the reasons for this delay. They played such a minor role in Kahr's plans that it wasn't considered necessary. Hitler suspected that Kahr had become frightened, and therefore wanted to force the Kahr-Lossow-Seisser Triumvirat to strike on November 8th with a spectacular action. Together with General Ludendorff, he intended to give the starting signal for the coup. But what he actually did was ruin Kahr's plan. After Hitler stormed the beer hall and forced Kahr's Triumvirat to cooperate, the three left the cellar and reversed their position within a few hours. In Berlin, Ebert and Stresemann reacted by transferring executive power to Reichswehr chief von Seeckt, hoping to achieve a unified stance against Hitler within the Reichswehr. And they succeeded. The units in Bavaria refused to march on Berlin under Hitler and Ludendorff, and due to the Reichswehr troops stationed in Saxony and Thuringia, this was impossible anyway. Hitler was thus left with only 2,500 men under his command. As is well known, Hitler's putsch was then crushed by the Bavarian police on the morning of November 9, 1923. To conceal its own involvement, the Bavarian government seized control of the trials related to the Hitler putsch and swept aside all claims of Kahrs and his associates' participation. For the sake of peace, Berlin backed down, as the Bavarian putsch attempt had collapsed and was not repeated. Furthermore, parts of the political right had come to realize that a right-wing coup would likely have resulted in the French permanently keeping the Rhineland and the Ruhr region. Source 1 concludes on page 220. When discussing the Hitler putsch today, the dictatorial ambitions of German nationalist and national conservative circles, particularly those in Bavaria, should be given far greater focus than has been the case for decades. In the autumn of 1923, they posed a far greater threat to democracy. The putsch attempts of 1923 clearly demonstrate how numerous and powerful the enemies of the Republic were. Their plan to harness Hitler and his populist nationalist friends to their cause failed and ended in a fiasco for them. By acting unilaterally, Hitler thwarted their putsch plans. Unwittingly, he thus gave the Democrats the chance to save the Weimar Republic when it already seemed lost. How did the political parties react to this chaos? The SPD withdrew from the government in protest against the Reichswehr's march against the Popular Front governments in Thuringia and Saxony, in which the SPD was also involved, and because the Reichswehr did not march against Bavaria. Chancellor Stresemann thus lost his majority. He consequently lost a vote of confidence in the Reichstag at the end of November and was forced to resign. After only 100 days as chancellor, his time at the head of government was over. However, these 100 days had decisively shaped the country. The ruinous Ruhr conflict had ended, and the period of confrontation with the Western powers had come to a close. Hyperinflation had been successfully combated, and the government had successfully weathered several uprisings. Gustav Stresemann remained in German politics as foreign minister. He held this post in every government until 1929. At least in foreign policy, he was able to provide the country with stability and predictability. And despite his successes as chancellor, he would reach the pinnacle of his career as foreign minister. Unlike his opponents on the right, he recognized that Germany's return to the international stage was only possible through the repair of relations with France. Source 2 states on page 290, "As foreign minister, Stresemann had the opportunity and the will to achieve one political goal above all. The restoration of Germany's great power status in concert with the other European great powers and the United States." As early as the end of 1923, he had forced France to acknowledge that the secession of the Rhineland and the Ruhr region from Germany was impossible. Poincaré's electoral defeat in the spring of 1924 allowed Stresemann to attempt a fresh start with a new French government. Together with the French Foreign Minister Aristide Briand, he succeeded in establishing reasonably good relations with France for the first time in decades, if not centuries. In 1924, the Dawes Plan was developed as the first, albeit temporary, reparations plan for Germany. Stresemann played a key role in ensuring its acceptance by Germany. While its adoption obligated Germany to make substantial reparations payments, it also facilitated the withdrawal of French troops from the Ruhr region, which was completed in the summer of 1925. Furthermore, the Dawes Plan enabled the use of foreign loans, which contributed to the Golden Twenties. When Field Marshal von Hindenburg became Reich President in 1925, he, like the right-wing forces, wanted to take a hard line in foreign policy and revert to a confrontational approach. Stresemann played a key role in dissuading him from this course of action, forcing him to acknowledge reality instead. Operational war games conducted by the Reichswehr had demonstrated that the Reich's military strength was barely sufficient for defensive actions against Poland. Action against France was utterly impossible. Fantasies of militias and rapidly mobilized units were absurd in an era of modern armies equipped with artillery, aircraft, and tanks. No one could explain why a disarmed Germany of 1925 could accomplish what a fully armed Germany of 1917 had failed to achieve. Stresemann was therefore able to continue his policies. He played a part in Hindenburg's election, as he had not supported the centrist candidate Wilhelm Marx. The Treaty of Locarno in 1925 established a new foundation for Franco-German relations. The western border was permanently recognized, but not the eastern border. Stresemann had sought a revision of the borders with Poland, which, however, never came to pass. In 1926, Germany joined the League of Nations, the precursor to the United Nations, as an equal member. In the same year, Stresemann and Briand were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Stresemann was the first German to receive this prize. In 1926, Germany was able to renew the 1922 Treaty of Rapallo with the Soviet Union through the Treaty of Berlin, thereby maintaining its room for maneuver in the East. Stresemann was also involved in the Young Plan, which in 1929 and 30 restructured reparations and replaced the Dawes Plan. This treaty reduced Germany's annual payments, but also extended them until 1988. On the other hand, the treaty ensured that the French finally left the Rhineland by mid-1930, after more than 10 years of occupation, an event that Stresemann would not live to see. His foreign policy made him a constant target of the political right, who accused him of selling out German interests. His health, already fragile since a heart attack in 1919, suffered further deterioration. He required increasingly frequent and lengthy stays at health resorts. His own party, the German People's Party, was also reluctant to continue pursuing a course of rapprochement with France and cooperation with the Social Democratic Party. The DVP, steadily losing votes, attempted to shift further to the right and adopt radical positions. In 1928, Stresemann was forced to more or less compel his party into a coalition with the SPD. Source 3 states on page 267, "It was noteworthy that Stresemann in this context was fond of pointing to the patriotic merits of the SPD in the First World War, from whose ranks more had perished on the battlefields than from all other parties combined." The struggle with the right wing of his party only ended on Stresemann's deathbed. Source 3 states on page 337, "Stresemann spent the last hours of his life trying to persuade his own party to maintain the coalition. His death on October 3, 1929 not only ended an era in foreign policy, but also marked the definitive defeat of the conciliatory forces within the DVP. Gustav Stresemann served in governments of the Weimar Republic for 6 years and 3 months, more than any other Weimar head of government. His death more or less marked the end of the Weimar Republic's golden years. Without Stresemann, the Grand Coalition collapsed within a few months, and the final phase of the Weimar Republic began, the era of presidential cabinets." Chancellor Hermann Müller said the following about Stresemann at his funeral on October 6, 1929, printed on page 119 in source 4. "Gustav Stresemann was not afraid of unpopularity. He was one of those true leaders so often called for, but whom the parties, when they truly want to lead, often follow only reluctantly, and to whom the gratitude owed is often only repaid after they have spent their lives." Stresemann was honored with a state funeral, attended by hundreds of thousands, the largest turnout since the funeral of Emperor Wilhelm I. Source 3 concludes on page 268 with the following about Gustav Stresemann. "Stresemann was among the outstanding European statesmen of his era. However, he was never a European in a deeper sense.
His decisive merit lay in having sought direct understanding with France instead of succumbing, like his predecessors and successors, to the chimera that France could be diplomatically isolated.
A few words about Stresemann's private life. Stresemann's wife, Käthe Kleefeld, was the daughter of a couple who had converted from Judaism to Protestantism. This had consequences from 1933 onward. Stresemann's sons, Wolfgang and Joachim, born in 1904 and 1908 respectively, studied law and political science during the Weimar Republic. Käthe Kleefeld was more or less the First Lady of the Reich during Stresemann's time as foreign minister. The diplomatic corps and the leading figures of Berlin's political scene met at her home almost weekly. Even during the Weimar Republic, she faced anti-Semitic attacks. From 1935 onward, she was considered a full Jew. Before the outbreak of World War II, she emigrated to the USA with her son Wolfgang. Joachim had already emigrated to America before them. Wolfgang Stresemann, who changed career paths to conducting, returned to Germany in 1956 and was the general manager of the Berlin Philharmonic until the mid-1980s. Käthe Kleefeld died in New York in 1970, Joachim Stresemann died in 1999 and Wolfgang Stresemann in 1998.
A few finishing words.
Stresemann's death in October 1929 marked more than just the end of a political career. It was the fading signal of an era that would soon be swallowed up by the stock market crash and the clamor of the streets. What remains is the image of a bridge builder in a time of great peril. Diplomacy is often the quietest but also the most difficult path. Something to remember when it becomes clear how fragile peace can be and how quickly time can slip away for solutions. In this context, I would like to conclude by quoting Source 2, page 527. This passage clearly shows that history does not repeat itself, but sometimes it does rhyme. How familiar does this sound to the ears of the 2020s?
As skillful as Gustav Stresemann was as a politician, he found it increasingly difficult to cater to the growing nationalist sentiment. Shortly before his untimely death in the autumn of 1929, he began to realize that this was not merely a reactionary minority. The enemies of the Weimar Republic on the right were of all ages, from young to old. Most of them did not want to restore the monarchy, but hoped for a seemingly attractive future, the outlines of which, however, remained vague. They despised what they considered a morally dubious system. The republican governments, held together by fragile parliamentary majorities, could indeed point to considerable successes, but this was not the message that resonated with the citizens. Populist rhetoric and club activism ridiculed parliaments, parties, and bureaucracies as rigid and worn out. Attempts by official bodies to curb anti-republican activities only made things worse. Thank you. This was History Lost in Time.